When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You're listening to a Hindustan Times podcast brought to you by HT Smartcast.
Hi, this is Manjula Narayan, National Books Editor, Hindustan Times, and this is the Books and Authors podcast. It's a weekly podcast where I speak to authors who've got a new book out. Hi, so today we have with us Nusrat F. Jafri, who is the author of This Land We Call Home, the story of a family, caste, conversions and modern India. Hi, Nusrat.
Hi, Manjula.
So, you know, Nusrat, I was reading the book and, you know, I found it really fascinating how you've combined your family history with the history of the nation, you know, with the recent history of the nation, you see, I mean, maybe the last 100 years or so. So, yeah. You tell, to begin with, let's just start with why you decided to write this book.
So the story always fascinated me, the story of Bhathus. And it was almost never told to me the way I've eventually researched and written. It was told as, you know, like just in bits that my great-grandparents belonged to this tribe. And they were criminalized by the British, but they considered themselves Robin Hoods. So, I mean, as a child, it's interesting. You want to know more, but not enough is being given to you, because my parents' generation, as my mother says, they didn't have that kind of relationship with their parents where they would ask questions. So information was just given to them, and there was that relationship wasn't even there where they could ask more, and it was on the mood of the parent. So for me, I was always fascinated by this. And as I started growing up, I was always a politically aware child, even in my teenage years. And because my father was into politics, I mean, interested in politics, not into politics. So I started piecing things together that most conversions to Christianity happened from locals in India. Like in Islam, you still find people traveling from outside of India, as is the case with my father's ancestors. But most Christians in India are homegrown Christians. They have come from castes. I tried looking up on Bhathus, and there was this little Wikipedia half page which gives literally no information about them. And my parents didn't know much either. And so it kind of got me curious. I was like, I need to know more, because can an entire tribe be thieves? Because that's the information floating around online. And all this information is written by either British historians, British travelers. And I felt that there's a bias, because I know that my ancestors were hunter-gatherers. They were herders. They had like 100 goats, and it's difficult to run with booty if you have 100 goats. You know, you'll be stationed in one place for at least months. Yeah. So I could tell the bias. I could see through it. And the other thing about telling the story of India simultaneously is the fact that my mother was born in the same year when India got its independence. I was fascinated by that as well. So if India was 18, my mother was 18. So it was interesting to see that. And of course, I was looking for a way to tell that story. So, it only fell in naturally that I would tell it through also the story of the nation.
Okay. But, you know, when you start with the Bhathus, you know, your mother's ancestry going back a few generations, there's so little on it. So how did you find all the material? Because you have created a picture which then the reader can understand. You know what I mean? Like when you start off, I had never heard of the Bhathus. I mean, there's so many tribes in India, and you've heard of criminal tribes and all that. You've heard that, you know that the British had called a whole set of people, labeled them all criminal tribes. But specifically, you don't know. I mean, the general reader doesn't know. You have to be somehow related to that, ancestry to know it, right? So, and to know its particularities. But then, if there's no written stuff on it, how did you manage to find out stuff? I was
So
fascinated.
there is written stuff, but mostly through an Orientalist lens. So you have to sieve through. You get a lot of information from what the British were documenting, and there's also there is I mean, I spoke extensively to relatives, and I've got anecdotes from each one of them. Somebody, and they're all over 60 now. My mamas and my aunts, my mother's 75 plus. So when you go and interview a senior citizen, so to speak, they don't give you all the information in one go. They'll remember slowly. They also don't want to tap into some years of their life. So it was a slow process sourcing the oral history. And then I spoke to Dakshin Chahara, who's a Bhatu activist. And very early on in my research, I was led to him by another tribal activist whom I just found on Facebook, D. Konda Narsingh Rao, his name is. And D. Konda asked me that I must, he told me, you must speak to Dakshin. But for some reason or the other, I hadn't spoken to Dakshin till I finished my first part. And then I had to revisit it after I spoke to Dakshin again, because Dakshin is a, he belongs to a caste called Chahara, which is a tribe called Chahara, sorry, which is a Bhatu tribe itself. So in different provinces, in different areas, Bhatus are known by different names, but they're all under the same tribe, parent tribe, so to speak. So speaking to Dakshin also got in a lot of insight in a lot of mannerisms and their customs, which up till now were kind of patchy in the oral history bits. And when I spoke to Dakshin, I found a more coherent way to thread information that I had, plus that he provided. There is stuff written by Sleeman, and but yeah, but you have to understand, like, while you're reading, there's stuff which I've written in the book as well. There are, they would club everyone as, like, you can, there are facial markers apparently of criminals, which is all a broad generalization, like hawk-eyed, hooked nose.
Glittering eyes, I think you said that.
Yeah,
The men
I
have
know.
glittering eyes. I mean, what is that?
I know.
So.
Yeah. So there was a lot of reading that helped, and there have been some information in the world of academia which is not accessible to people like me as well. So I had to, like, pay up in online libraries, get some stuff out. So I'm hoping that my book would provide an easier access to this history.
And then when I was reading it, I also thought that there is so many communities like this that the mainstream in inverted commas knows nothing about, right? And that's a large part of our history, right? So hopefully, there'll be more books like this which
Yeah, I mean, it's a large part of our history, as well as the role of Bhatus and other so-called criminal tribes, nomads, in the their contribution to the freedom struggle. It's not spoken about. They were singing
At
songs
all.
of dissent, and they were passing messages between revolutionaries. Because of the nomadic nature, they could do that. So these things are rarely spoken about. I mean, I didn't know about the freedom struggle till I actually started writing this, their contribution in the stream struggle, sorry. So there's this, and there was a lot of glorification of the thievery in popular culture. I mean, there was a recent movie, Shamshera, which is showing a British colonial forted area, a settlement of criminal tribes. But it's also warped in its presentation, right? They're shown with having superpowers of sorts, like the power to call crows. So I'm like, yeah. There's an occasional Sultana Daku story, which is he's probably the most famous Bhatu.
So the Bhatu that your great grandfather was mistaken for, right, when he was attacked by, Yes,
yes,
so
yes.
what I also found great, and you find this often in different communities, where even when they're marginalized communities like the Batus, they have, because of their connection to certain other, through their history or through their alleged history to
Yes.
certain more prominent communities, they don't consider themselves as outcast, even if they are treated as
Yes.
outcast. You know that, and you
Yeah.
brought out that complexity very well. So, but how did you arrive at that understanding?
I'm sorry, you're asking about the
The
Bhatu, the
Bhatus and
realization of
the
those
Rajput
being.
connection, because
Oh,
of the
yes, that
Rajput
is
connection.
actually, yeah. That's a very interesting part of my history, because everyone in our childhood and now actually my maternal side will always tell you that they were Bhatu Rajputs. And when I started researching, Bhatu Rajputs is it's like a weird term, right? Bhatus is a tribe who are not Hindus. They don't fall in the Hindu fold. They are outcasts that way. Then there are Rajputs who are Kshatriyas. So what is this unique term? I wanted to go into that for sure. And I was like, this is interesting because they have a lot of pride. The Rajput pride is associated. My great grandfather used to sport that handlebar mustache, which is a Rajput legacy of sorts. They own it. So but this is real. This is happening. This had happened. Like they were. So what was this concession that they got, or what was this arrangement that they were allowed? I was curious to know that. And then I landed on this term called Rajputization, which I think on two occasions separately written about it in the book as well, which is a very fascinating thing, because this is how tribes and castes have evolved, and they have they've intersected in many ways during the course of history. Even when I was talking to Sarovar Zaidi, who's an anthropologist, she had also mentioned that caste lines are also, they can overlap even with professions. So likewise, I don't know that far deep into history, but I'm told that at some point these ancestors may have belonged to the army of this great Rajput ruler, Rana Pratap, and hence, because for their contribution, they were allowed to carry the Bhatu Rajput tag and the mustache. But beyond that, their socio-economic conditions were not reflective of a Rajput lifestyle. The fact that they had to suffer, they were driven towards something else, towards another identity, are telling of the fact that clearly they didn't have those benefits that Rajputs enjoy in society. And this has happened in history with a lot of other tribes, a lot of other castes who will be allowed to. A friend of mine recently told me that he's from Faizabad, which is near Ayodhya, and normally only upper castes can ride a horse for their weddings. And this was a Thakur area, and a Muslim wedding was happening. And Muslims also have a caste system, which, because of my privilege, I learned very late in life. But this Muslim lower caste groom was riding a horse, and in the Thakur area, which and he was allowed to. Whereas we read news articles where one is not allowed to if you're not from that caste, and people take great offense, and there's violence in weddings. So he asked, and they said, "Nay, nay, these people are ours. At some point, we have allowed them to kind of intersect with our identity." That is what I mean. Why I'm telling you this example is that these kind of concessions have been happening in caste society, and they are intricate. They are difficult to lay in just black and white.
That's true. I mean, I guess this idea of it being black and white is also a legacy from the colonial times, where
Yes.
where everything was demarcated. Perhaps we are not,
Yes.
we were not that rigid in those things. Perhaps, who knows?
Yes, because and that's how I think the colonial criminal tribes acts came in the first place. Like there is this population who is not falling in the caste system that we know of, and they are not sedentary. They keep traveling. We can't control them. So let's just, and even transgender people came under the purview of this.
I know you mentioned. So it's basically a lack of the colonizers' un grasp of nuance or something,
Yes, and that's also post 1857. They needed to control in other ways than.
That's true. So, I mean, like when I was reading your book and I was thinking there's so many strands within your family, and you are like sort of privileged to know that, in recent history there are many strands. There's the Christian, and there's the originally Bhatu Rajput, and there's the Shia Muslim side, and all this, and so in a sense it's a how does one put it? It's a very composite sort of picture, right? So, but does that kind of make it harder or make it easier for you?
This is basically the core of the book as well, that there are so many histories within this one big history of the country that run parallel to everything. And this is what makes the nation at the end of the day. So yes, I mean, at times, like I mentioned, at times it's difficult. Identity is, you are trying to find your identity. Like growing up, I would sometimes call myself half Muslim, half Christian. And sometimes I would just call myself Christian. So, it's just like aaj mood hai to aaj bol deti, but I had that privilege. So yeah, so I mean you're also exposed to a much wider cultural composition, a cultural I mean you can choose for that. And but the cons are that you also don't have one solid sense of belonging to any one thing, which you develop when you grow up. You realize that, oh, okay, I mean I think I want to explore more of this. And so those things come up. Yeah, it comes with both. There's definitely more exposure as a child if you're growing in a cosmopolitan environment like I did. And that kind of makes it, you already have a level of a sense of acceptance of other cultures, and you're open to much more than just had it just been a endogamous house, and we've just been married into each other and only in our tribe, only in our religion. So
That's
I was
true.
aware of that when I was growing up as well.
Yeah, and I found it like the bits where you deal with the cousins who are being so snooty.
Your breed.
It's fun. It's actually quite funny, but it's also sad that people still do think like this. No, I mean that's what this whole purity thing
Yes,
is about, right? Caste and that.
absolutely,
So, I mean, you mentioned how you
absolutely.
handled it, but was that regular?
I think it's regular. This suspicion with anything that is out of the norm, it's kind of human nature, right? You look at somebody else who's not all you, all that you follow. You have a little bit of a suspicious first impression of that person, that okay, this person is different from us in many ways. So that, unfortunately, even though my mother is such a devout Muslim and converted and everything, I would still feel that her past of being Christian at one point in her life, it always plays around and also kind of overshadows our identity in many ways as being half Christian, half Muslim, even though, I mean, I don't know. So this continues. One need, I think one just learns to ignore these things and just move ahead. I mean, I see that in my own house as well, because I'm married to a Bengali, and I've seen this with my own child having to face, because some people from Bengali side would come and start talking to him Bengali and then say, oh, you don't know Bengali. Like, yes, he wouldn't know Bengali the way you do because it's not spoken in his house, but he might know a little bit of Bengali, a little bit of Urdu, a lot of English. So I mean there's a lot of other things happening as well. But some of these things will come and reinforce. You can get it. I mean, your receptors are high when you are from a mixed background. So you do realize these.
And like you mentioned, about privilege not privilege kind of stopping you from realizing about the existence of caste even within Muslims in India.
Yes.
And this is only, I mean, with it's only recently that the general populace also has realized this. One always thought that it's more egalitarian, the principle of brotherhood and all that, right, in Islam. When you know that Indian Muslims also have, I mean, now one.
Absolutely.
So, how did you, you came to that realization, right? Because, I mean, from privileged backgrounds, we are often brought up without any knowledge of caste also,
So caste was definitely not a part of my childhood, because of the privilege that I have spoken about. Because I mean, it's because we didn't have to face what the people in the lower castes have to. So that definitely was absent in my childhood, the awareness, because of the privilege again. And as I grew older, of course, the causes of low caste Muslims came around, and this myth that I mean, I know that in Islam and even in Christianity, everyone is equal before God and written on paper, but we have very conveniently accepted the caste system within our folds in Asia, in the Indian subcontinent. So if you were a weaver before you converted, you are a weaver. You will be referred to, and your colonies are different. I have read Ghazala Wahab's Born a Muslim, and she writes so beautifully about this as well, how there are in I think in Agra there were these entire gullies belonging to weaver Muslims. So this is the same caste segregation that we talk about in Hindu society as well, right? And picking up conversations from elders, like people would say a certain surname in within Muslims and say, oh, acha, they are that caste. And so perhaps they were there, but because I was not one of those surnames, I didn't have to face that. But yeah, now, I mean, there were, I have heard these comments. I paid attention to these comments when I was older. I may not have registered them when I was younger, but yeah, but that was also because I didn't know about the Hindu caste system either that time. I didn't know too much about this one being Brahmin and that auntie being Kshatriya. While I was writing this book, unfortunately, I started paying a lot of attention to surnames because I read so much about caste. And at one point, I was embarrassed, but that was all in, it was all internalized embarrassment as even realizations. I was like, okay, if I'm reading about it, imagine being belonging to such a rigid caste system and believing in it, then you would always be doing this, right? Oh, you're a Sharma ji. In your mind, you play the. You can't, like I said in the book, you can't escape caste in India. You may convert, you may move ahead, you think you've moved ahead, but it will come. It keeps coming back to you somehow or the other.
And I was also quite fascinated that you've spoken to so many relatives and your aunts, and clearly you've spent a lot of time with older people within the family and even maybe cousins also, and got stuff out of them. So talk about that,
Yeah, this is pertaining to their childhood, or you mean the Bhatu bit? Because I've written about
Anything,
both.
the childhood, even even the Lucknow locality, which actually it reminds me of Sara Rai's book. She also refers to community space in Lucknow, I think. Sara Rai's Premchand's granddaughter, and her mother is mother was also Shia. So the same, those bits kind of about this. I was wondering, is it the same? Is it the same locality? Are you related? Possibly. Who knows? Anyway.
Who knows actually? Yeah, it was actually interesting to talk to them because see, when I started writing, they didn't know that I was this is going to translate into an actual book because I started writing it with South Asia Speaks. The year-long mentorship that I had gotten into. So people were, it took me many phone calls and many visits to people to get them to tap into these early memories of theirs. So all the memories of their Nana which is Reverend Hardayal, were all happy memories because he was living in this village, Biswa, open grounds, village lifestyle. It was all very happy stuff for them. But I mean, also their childhood with their father's addiction in the later years, while some of them were even small, those were the tough ones for me to tap into, because that's, I think, the memory nobody wants to voluntarily get into, especially my mother. It was difficult for mommy to get into it, and I could see the fatigue setting in, and she's like, aaj itna hi baat karna hai, you know, I don't want to get in, and I could understand why. So, and also, you know, when you're telling these stories, you also choose how much of somebody's very, very personal bits you want to talk about while writing a memoir. So that kind of thieving also happened at many stages on my part, because I wanted to be respectful of her trust in telling a story to me. But while she was talking to me, there was a lot of, I could feel it was challenging, difficult, draining for her to do that. So in the end, I would sit with the material and I would actually think, how much do I need to pour into the book and not get her to feel uncomfortable later.
Yeah.
But all the Bhatu bits, but I also realized while I was writing the Bhatu stories, there was a lot of, the story was narrated to each one of them in a very happy way. So they all remembered whatever they narrated to me about the Bhatu adventures, about goats and having buffaloes and lying under the sky with stars and stuff. These are all memories that were very happy for them. And at no point was there a criminal tribe tag hanging behind each of these stories. And my Nana used, my maternal grandfather was a jailer, assistant jailer. And he had at one point told my mother that indeed Bhatus are labeled under criminal tribes, erstwhile criminal tribes in records. So it kind of, you know, it was told to them as well in these many, within their Bhatu circle, ex-Bhatu circle, so to speak. So those things came to me in various different anecdotes, not all at once. Perhaps the biggest fright for them was the fact that historically, Bhatus and some of the other tribes like Bhils and Kanjar tribes, Nats, they're all unanimously agreed to be one of the first citizens, people from India, like people who are actually all from India, the first tribes. Yeah. So that pride also translated. And at some point last year, I think we got DNA tests done just to trace our ancestry further. And my mother's 99 or 100% Indian, like out and out.
Wow.
And yeah, and that's how as Indian as you can get.
But
so I have similar ancestry, Central Asia. And of course, there's Iraq, Iran, quite a lot of it because there's a very strong association from there. There's Bengali. I'm actually more Bengali than my own son. So my mother has a lot of South Indian. You can actually follow the migration that somebody at some point had come from Africa. Everybody comes from there. So they had come. They were in Sri Lanka, Tamil Nadu. So much of her is Tamil and Bengali. And then, of course, Rajasthan, Pakistan area, which is the Bhatu settlement areas. But it was, I mean, this is what I was saying, that like, how do you prove how Indian you are? If not by this, then how?
And what
people
is
have to question you. I mean, given these little things about, you know, the National Registry of Citizens and this, that. So, I mean, this is all very recent. People are dating back and.
Yeah, and then outwardly you might think that you're the epitome of the great, I don't know, whatever.
Exactly,
person. But then you end up having so many different streams within. So I wonder what people like that, how they accept these things. If you're so
rigid.
No,
it's difficult.
Yeah.
It's a little.
Anyway, so I was wondering, sir, when you're speaking to these people, your mother and, you know, aunts and everything, isn't there did you encounter this feeling that they were censoring themselves also, you know, because you know, especially when
they were censoring. Yeah,
so
that's why I mentioned that when my mother did pour her heart out, and it, it does become Meera's story, Meera and Prudence's story. Prudence, unfortunately, I couldn't get to interview during the course of writing this book, but Meera is there, and she was censoring herself to quite a lot of extent. And then it became a little bit of a cathartic exercise that I would call and I would ask her, and slowly, slowly, she did start telling a lot of these details of her childhood. So where, if I saw resistance in telling an anecdote, I kind of also weighed in, should I put this in? Is it really imperative for my, I mean, it will add that raw honesty that everyone keeps talking about, but can I do without that bit?
Yeah.
So yes, I have also exercised certain censorship, as I'm sure other writers do as well. So I wanted to be careful of the information and retell it in a way where I should be happy with my mother reading this book and her family not feeling very uncomfortable as well. So yeah, those things, of course. But some of my other aunts and uncles did not tap into those bits at all. So it took my mother to open up.
Oh. Okay,
to me in other ways, yeah.
But you know, things like her aunt, your mother's aunt's kind of like cutting all contact with her mother, and
yes,
you know,
yes,
that
yeah,
slap and everything before she got married.
Yeah.
All those things must have been really traumatic, no?
Yes,
and then not telling your grandmother that her father's died. I mean, that was like the
yeah,
ultimate
that was horrible,
horrible, horrible. That's horrible. So
absolutely, yeah, those.
Those things, you know,
yes.
So much grief. And so I was wondering, when you know, you're talking about your grandmother, how did she go back to her sisters after that? You know, how did she?
Yeah, that's the thing with Indian families. Our constitution is such, no, we just, we love to go back, give another chance, come back fighting. And then after 6 months, you know, like, beheni to hai.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, I would have thought that, you know, she'd find it absolutely unforgivable. You know, just cannot forgive that.
Absolutely, yeah. It,
yeah.
It wasn't a small thing. And repeatedly
yeah.
stuff like that kept happening.
And just because you allow your daughter to marry a Muslim man, I mean, it's
out
bizarre.
Of religion. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Gosh.
Yeah.
So talking about this, I don't know whether it was cathartic, like you said, or whether it was like traumatic,
yeah.
reliving it.
I would say both.
So what has your family's reaction been to it, like your aunts and uncles? And,
so
know?
They haven't read it. And I was also a little apprehensive of how they're going to perceive, because a lot of things are going to be new for them, like the Bhatu association with Rajputs. Like, I don't think they know, I don't think that they know that Bhatus are Bhatus and Rajputs are Rajputs, because they've not really asked those questions, and they moved here, they grew up Christian. So I don't think there was a lot of tapping into the past required while they were growing up. And like I said, they grew up in a generation where they were not asking questions. Information would be given to them, and there was hardly any heart-to-heart talking happening. So I think I would be interested in knowing some of their reactions, because there are some, my uncle is extremely politically aware and he likes history. I would like to know his reaction. I'm sure he's going to be like, he'll find it fascinating, because this is something which I don't think they knew. I have to tell my mother as well about this. I was like, there's hardly anything called Bhatu Rajputs. I mean, clearly you grew up with that because of the favor granted upon this particular clan of Bhatus. But yeah, all Bhatus are not Bhatu Rajputs. So yeah, that my mother has read it. She really liked it. And she felt like I told the story well. And she did mention that by part three of the book, where all the politics steps in, identity politics and politics of the country, she said she was not very interested in that page. So I was like, okay.
Yeah, but I like how you wove everything together, you know. Yeah, the you know, we think of ourselves as maybe separate from what's happening. But your book kind of shows that, no, everything is, you know, part of us, like politics is
yes.
possible, you know. So you've
yes.
managed to get that out. So which is
thank you.
Right. So you know, we were talking about you know, the whole thing about TV coming into our lives and the Ramayana and the whole neighborhood turning up to watch it on TV. And this is like a common experience in the 80s for everybody in India, right? So
Yes.
let's, and those seem like more innocent times, but perhaps they weren't. We don't know. Maybe it's our own sepia tinted sort of vision that makes us think that because 1984 happened, and then 1993 was waiting to happen, and on and on. Every decade there's this violent, it seems like it, a violent outburst, So let's talk about that. And are we like condemned to keep on repeating this or what?
Yeah, it seems like we are no condemned to keep repeating because we're clearly not learning. And so, I mean, when I was small, I mean, 80, I think 82 was when the Nelly massacre happened. That is something which went so underreported that I discovered it very late when I was studying in Jamia because a senior made a documentary on it years, years, years later. And I asked my mother later on, it's not part of the book, is of course. And she said, yeah, I do remember some reading some bit about it, but it was, I mean, it just largely went unnoticed, only this big massacre of Muslims that happened in Nelly in Assam. And then Meerut was there.
But
We obviously everybody knows about.
Nelly was also, it was like also a Bengali Assamese thing.
Yeah, but it
It
was
was
still a targeted
Muslim. Yes, of course it was
attack.
targeted.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course it was
Yeah. And
targeted.
numbers involved were still very big to for it
Huge.
to.
And just disappeared.
But you know, yeah. But there is a consequence of that. An uncle, my father's uncle used to work, or was it a cousin? He was working in one of the in one of those tea estates, and he had to leave because the environment became a little tense that side as well. So there were, it wasn't without repercussions for other people from the same community. So yeah, it keeps happening. These things are so, again, they're politically driven, and as a society, we don't learn. We also keep forgiving and accepting them in our stride. Speaking to Hussein for the book, I know Hussein is younger than me, but I don't know why. I just said, and you know, during Babri Masjid, he said, Ustad, Babri time, I was very young, and but I do remember Godhra. So I was like, oh yeah, I just keep thinking all these things kind of thread all of us into this common thing. But it's also about the age, like you said, when we were growing up watching Ramayana and Mahabharata, while that was collecting all of us together, there were these incidences which remind you of your of certain things, the cracks in society. So yeah, I mean, for other generations, there are other things to speak about. Yeah.
Like how the 70s they about the emergency and all that, right? And the curtailing of those freedoms, and that bit where you talk about sterilization, the mass sterilizations. And that reminded me also of this Maithili Srinivas has done this great book on the whole family
Drive.
planning program, and how your family is unusual in that they chose to
They still went ahead with, in spite of such a big,
It was a big brainwashing thing at the national level, right? Because
That was a big political event. I mean, it really was a really, I mean, just losing your fundamental rights, the state machinery taking over to do this big coordinated drive of just going ahead and sterilizing people against their wishes. So it is actually a very big, dark chapter in our history. And I always found it fascinating because my parents, in spite of this thing, still have, they had gone ahead and had the number of children they wanted to have, because it's like a I don't know, it's a sort of defiance in many ways. It can be looked as an economical foible as well, because I mean, each time you have a child, it's going to put more economic pressure on you. So it's interesting that against all odds, you did go ahead, you did what you wanted to do, and yet it had a very big impact on them because I've written about my mother choosing a home delivery at one point and how it
Yes.
almost cost her a life. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
Yeah, that
I
is very
mean,
scary
she
part.
was saved. Yeah, she was saved, but there are so many people who lost their lives who
Yeah.
have people don't know about it only because they would have done the same thing because there were, my mother tells me there were so many rumors as well that you just go in for a delivery and they'll tie do a ligation at the same time. So this is scary for people. They don't want to get that done. They just want to go deliver a child. So
Yeah.
many women may have chosen, like people who are economically better off and not better off. Everybody facing the same fear
Yeah.
that
Yeah.
they don't have rights right now.
Yeah. And even now, like when people talk about when you've pointed out that, going forward, like we are no longer overpopulated. But we still think that, I mean, it's each to their to her own. You can have as many children as you want. But even that is a freedom, right? You choose to have whether you choose to have more children or fewer children. It's up to you.
Oh
So
no, yeah, absolutely.
yeah, and then now it's like almost blasphemous if you have a third child. It's like, my God, what is wrong with you? And it's, I
Yeah,
realize it's only
absolutely.
Indians who think like this. No?
I know. And the other
And
day, I was just watching a reel of this American couple who live in a truck, I think, and they have eight children, and it was only Indians who were writing underneath, "What is wrong with you?
you?
You live in a truck. You have eight children." I still get the same reaction from people when they ask me how many siblings you have. I'll every time I say we are seven of us, the reaction hasn't changed for us. I was going to say that it's always an impolite reaction. It has, and somebody even asked me, "Same mother?" I was like, "Yeah, same mother." Yeah.
And we've forgotten that, larger families, like when you go forward, others you'd be end up like Japan, with nobody looking after
Yeah,
their own
yeah.
people because there aren't enough people. Like all these things,
Yeah.
you just when that whole policy was being formulated, nobody thought of these things, and it's
Yeah.
only after maybe China started suffering that we thought, oh God, maybe, thank God we
Yeah,
didn't go that
yeah.
extreme, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And see, this is again a relevant conversation to have in today's time because there are some states like Uttar Pradesh who are considering a two-child norm. And it's okay to have campaigns running around this concept, but to say that you will face economic consequences if you have your third, which is a very China policy,
Yeah.
then it becomes all like, like it loses its when you don't have choice in a matter, then I
Yeah.
don't know. People have all kinds of other non-incentives to go in for because people will also be defiant.
Yes.
There will always be a sect of people who will be like, we'll do what we feel like doing.
Yeah.
People have many reasons to have a lot of children, as
Yeah.
they say. Some of them say that a lot of poor people go ahead and so many children, and their reasons are that we need those hands. So
Yeah.
how do you need a better policy than saying ki you the state is allowing you just two children. I don't
Yeah.
know if that works. And it's
Yeah.
relevant because we still keep hearing this coming up
Yeah.
in
But
the political discourse.
even before this, even like generally like government jobs, I think they don't give you, if you have a third child, there are some repercussions.
Yeah,
Like
there are.
already, I mean, for decades it's been in place. So which is also unfair,
Yeah.
So, but anyway,
It is,
that's
yeah.
it's like sort of collective brainwashing that's happened to us, and we've accepted, many of us have accepted it. So
Yeah.
anyway, so I thought about that also when when you got to that bit about your family and having so many siblings, and I thought, isn't it great to have so many siblings?
Yeah, it was great growing up, yeah, in that house because there was always entertainment. We are all like friends because the age gap is never that much. Maybe just the eldest and the youngest have a big one. But otherwise there was a lot of friendship, a lot of naughtiness, a lot of good habits picking up. Like elder siblings are reading something and we as younger ones would also pick up the same thing because it's available to us. So there was a lot of sharing of good things, fights, a lot of stuff. A riot, I would say, all the time.
And also this thing about identity, in the playground. I mean, now it's become worse because of the political whatever atmosphere. But earlier, people would not directly ask, or this whole thing about you don't look Muslim. There's even a book, I think Rakshanda Jalil has written a book. The book is called "But You Don't Look Muslim." And is this a
Muslims.
question that people
It
often
is just
ask, or what? I mean, what does it mean?
absolutely. For the longest time, I have answered that question. Not so much in Lucknow, though, because Lucknow has a sizable a Muslim population, but still a minority, like not as good as, say, West Bengal or Kerala. But we have a good history with Islam and Nawabs. So it's not a rarity to be Muslim in Lucknow, but in classrooms, we would still be like three Muslims, two Christians, one Sikh girl, and the majority of others would be Hindus. But we didn't have this sense of otherness as such while I was growing up. And we never really lived in ghettos. So we were always, I've written about it as well, we were always trying to mingle with the majority in many ways. But when I moved to Delhi and I started living in this in the IP College hostel, and where there were not just Delhiites, exposure to Delhiites, but also to girls from Panipat, Meerut, Bhilai, and I don't know, West Bengals. When this unique concoction of other states, all of us met together, I would invariably be asked, "What's your name?" I would say, "My name is Nusrat." And the second question would be, "Oh, you're Muslim." And seniors would ask this question, means they've spent at least a year or two in Delhi already. So they should ideally not be asking this question, because now you must have met more Muslims than in your hometowns. So that was a little, so I think I was introduced to my Muslim identity for the first time in the hostel itself. And very often when I started interning with newspapers, very, very often I would hear this comment that you don't look Muslim, which led me to also question, what does a Muslim look like? I
They
mean,
mean
what do you
hijabi.
expect of?
Do they mean
Yeah,
hijabi?
they mean hijab, you're always wearing henna in your hands.
Who does
Yeah.
that?
So I was actually asked by a classmate that, what do I wear for swimming?
I know you mentioned that. You said burqa. I should have been a burqa. She accepted it as changed
She
it a joke. That's funny.
Yeah, so yeah, so
That
these things are so one auntie, in fact, when I went to somebody, I don't know if I mentioned this in the book, I don't remember, but she asked me how many siblings we are, and I said seven. And her next question was, "Yes, our sweeper also is Muslim, and he also has seven, eight children." And I was like, this auntie is drawing immediate parallel to, like, another Muslim also has so many children. I was like,
Oh my God. Anyway, so
okay. Yeah.
these sort of, I mean, these microaggressions, how do you deal with them?
I mean, you do an occasional rant here and there. I mean, I do a lot than just occasional on my social media handles, but you do, I mean, speak up. For me, so there was this entire phase where I was wanting to rebel against this Muslim identity. I wanted to just study in Delhi and get into journalism at that point when I was doing my undergrad. And this being Muslim, not looking like Muslim, being a different kind of Muslim, these extra sentences that would follow and attach themselves to my identity started irritating me. And at some point, I told my father that I'm having to answer so many vague questions, like all terrorists are Muslims and Muslims have too many children, so I just don't want to do anything with Islam. And my father was quiet for some time, and then later he said that, "You, as a privileged, educated Muslim, will not want to speak up. Then what was the point of this exercise of making you independent?" And it stayed with me. This, he must have said this to me when I was 19 or 20. And I actually saw Because I was also, like I said, a very politically aware child. I was also already interning with newspapers and I was getting good beats, political beats. So I understood that question. It's from a deep, my father was bringing us up to contribute in many ways to this discourse, not just, you know, just be one, mingle with the thing and don't speak up. And I just saw the, I mean, it's difficult to keep speaking about these things. You can become really unpopular amongst people for so-called spreading negativity, as they frame it. And I mean, like, you can't, you're not supposed to speak too much about these things. Like, you can't find a house on rent, or somebody said something mean or didn't think through before they pointed out your identity. You don't want people to keep speaking about it. So earlier I used to speak a lot. Now I kind of pick my battles as to when, at what point I should speak. But I speak. It is difficult. It is not easy to live with these things. I wouldn't say that I have found it affects. It affects me greatly.
And as somebody who's married to a, you know, a Bengali Hindu, you know, how do you maneuver that also? Because they're just like how people say stupid things, like, you know, you don't look Muslim. They must be saying some other stupid things also about the marriage, right? Both Hindus and Muslims.
And Muslims, yes. I've had, there's always navigation of these things when you do an inter-religion marriage. So, there have been things that I've had to navigate here as well. And I'm sure my husband has had to as well, because both sides can be, you know, like...
this is the first time, you know, when you talk about it, this... Something about reverse. What is this? Yeah. Note, Sumit cheerily insists I describe him as a Bhagwa love trap. It's the first time I heard about this, but in the book, a term used by some Hindutva organizations to denote a reverse love jihad. Seriously?
Yeah.
I mean, I was ignorant about this. Bhagwa love trap. This is hilarious.
I think it helps to have a partner with a sense of humor on these issues, and I think he's also largely atheist, and I also follow my religion with a lot of convenience at hand, so kind of helps, I think, that you choose, like I said, I choose what I want to spend my energy on. I might be soaking in a lot, but what issue do you really want to speak on? But largely we've been lucky with not too much resistance, and even in cultural exchanges within our two families, it's been very seamless. It's been, I think, that way we've been very lucky. Yeah, I don't really pay much attention to what extended people might be feeling, because that's something that I've learned from my mother's inter-religion marriage, when I'm like, the more you try, I mean, you can't keep everyone happy. So I have conveniently chosen things that I will do and things that I'm okay without doing as well.
And, you know, when I'm reading the book, I can see, you know, there's so many conversions, I think, from Batu to Methodist. So Methodist to Roman Catholic, you know, which is also a big difference, right? I mean, like, people might tend to think that all Christians are the same. They're not the same.
No,
just as all Hindus are not
all
the same, right? Then,
yeah.
Then and from that to, you know,
Islam
for
mommy,
and then your generation, I mean, the current generation where everybody follows whatever they choose to, you know, so there's that. So that's almost like very optimistic, you know, I felt that progression.
This progression is the, I was always aware of these many conversions taking place over these years, and I always found it interesting, because I find the conversions very fascinating in today's India, especially with the fact that we always have so many negative connotations attached to the word conversion.
Yes.
And I have seen this happen in our house. And so many of my close friends have also told me that we can't believe that your mother willingly converted to Islam, because there is no will attached. I mean, people who are educated have also said the same thing, that they must have expected her to. And And I've always like kind of, in fact, I actually asked my mother also this question while writing the book, that is it at some point my father expected you to, and you know, and she was like, she was the enthusiast here. She wanted to learn all these things. And in fact, she got very little support from her in-laws. So conversion, and even her name, she retained her name because classically people who don't even convert get a name, new name for the nikah, as you may have seen in like many famous actresses would have a name called Aisha or something. But these, they were very, what do you say, liberal in many ways when they did these things, like go ahead with your name and practice as much as you want to. So that conversion, I actually feel like talking about it more because earlier, when, like, for example, people were converting to the religion of their business partners, what is the coercion there? That you won't get a better deal if you just become, or in the newer age, I mean, I know so many of people in here in Bombay are doing Nichiren Buddhism, which is they get together and chant.
Yeah, what is that?
I
That is
mean,
conversion only, now. What are you doing?
exactly. This is an accept. And why are you doing it? You like sitting with that group, and you end up sitting and chanting together, and it gives you some kind of a peace. I know people in Bombay who have converted, who have no coercion of any sorts of converted to Christianity because they liked the act of telling the rosary, and they wear it. So it can be as mundane as this reason. We are just born into the religions. Do we want to wholeheartedly accept them? Just because society is formed in this way that we must adhere to it. Caste you cannot leave behind, perhaps, but religion you can change. So why won't people who get attracted to another religion? And again, people do so many strange things in love, and this was my mom's love and absolute fascination for my father that time. And I know people do that with dietary habits as well. They would want to, if they're vegetarian, they can try non-vegetarian so that, you know, like, they would try if they would actually succeed is different. Or even with vegetarianism, people have converted to vegetarianism because their partner was a vegetarian. So these things happen in relations. We now are paying too much attention to religious conversions. Everything comes with the connotations. There has to be a lack of agency in this. There has to be some monetary benefit. There has to be some political benefit. Not to say that perhaps these things have not happened. I mean, we are a very political society. Things may have happened that way as well, but we can't paint everything with the same brush.
But people convert for all sorts of reasons, like you've mentioned in the
Absolutely.
monetary reasons. I mean, if you're if you're starving and somebody comes to help you, why wouldn't you? What is even wrong with it,
Absolutely.
So.
And literally, my great grandparents saw the first missionaries who arrived for their help in this village, which was surrounded by upper caste people who were not helping them as their helpers, as their saviors.
Saviors,
And it's not surprising that they chose to then move ahead with them.
You would go with
But
who helps you,
but
right?
then there is also my Kannauji Brahmin great grandfather, my mother's dada, who was a Kannauji Brahmin. He converted as well, but he was a poor person. So there is something that lures you to another side, or there could be something, nothing also. Like I've spoken to Sarovar again, who's an anthropologist and also teaches at Ashoka. She mentioned that people were just converting in Maharashtra from upper caste Brahmanism to Christianity, like for no reasons of social political standing. It's just a way if sometimes people do things.
Or you might find that way of thinking, or it gives you something. That specific religion gives you something that you were looking for, right?
Or like Bishop Chidambar Rao, he took the Bible to his challenge inconsistencies within it and ended up converting. I mean, you can just
So
convert and
I really like that the Christian thing, the sections. where you spoke about all the great churn and all that. I mean, I feel it's kind of understudied or underrepresented. The maybe only Christian communities know about it, but the larger Indian society hasn't really focused on this. And why, online you hear people saying horrible things, but they were rice bag and all this,
Yeah,
the sort of rhetoric that people have. But
yes.
this kind of puts everything in context, and you see why people would convert, or the many reasons
Yes.
for it.
Yeah. So I also address this with the detachment from what colonial government was doing, because I mean, my own grandmother had her allegiance to the crown when she was growing up because they were her benefactors and stuff. But as a student of history, I would never agree with her, and we would have these little fights in the house. So when I was writing about these things, I didn't want to sound like, oh, they did these great things. They brought in the railways to India and the discipline. So those things, I steered away from them because I also don't believe too much in that, the goodness of those things. So, but we cannot deny that the first women's hospital happened in Bareilly with this one missionary woman who was called in Clara Swain, or that I grew up in Lucknow with crossing the Isabella Thoburn College, which is a big college in Lucknow, IT college, which is where most old time educated people have come out from, like many academics. And I didn't know the history beyond the IT, the Isabella Thoburn College, that cityscapes have changed with the movement of Christianity. And as much as we may want to judge their movements or their very visibility in these areas, or why they were there in the first place, we cannot deny the things that were brought in as well. They were not easy. There are also Nawabs involved in this, the Nawab of Rampur, by giving these generous land grants. These are histories which I found very fascinating, while because I started with the story of my grandparents, but I also wanted to see what was happening to the cities when these movements of religions were happening within. And I thought IT College in Lucknow or the Lucknow University, these are big landmarks. The Aligarh Muslim University, the church in Bareilly, this is the first ever church that came up in that area. So these things didn't happen just in isolation with the promise of evangelism only. There was more to it. It was not, so I found it fascinating how cities are being built with these big events happening parallelly.
Yes, and besides that, I found it fantastic when you point out that crochet, that you just throw it in just like that. But I was thinking, what the hell? So many of my friends sit and crochet, and I like think, wow, they're constantly giving me gifts of, caps and
Crochet,
in the winter
how sweet.
crochet, and you mentioned the Scottish missionary brought crochet to India, and then it became like through the Zenanas and through all the women, like
Yeah, it
fascinating.
was
I
used as a
wonder
medium to
if
find.
that,
Yeah, I'm so happy you noticed that, because I would excitedly put in a lot more, and then later think, should I put this? Because there was a lot on the way Christianity came to India as well, from South India, which I had to kind of edit out later to think, am I veering too much? So I had to keep thinking. I think the crochet bit also I weighed very heavily on. Should I provide this
Oh, I'm
information?
so
Should I, like,
glad you
am I?
provided it. I underlined it also. I said, wow, crochet.
Thank
Who
you.
knew? And the whole thing about your great aunts being nurses and
Yes.
all that, it gives you an idea of that women were doing things. Otherwise we just think,
Yeah.
oh, what are they doing there? Nothing. And then it's only post-60s and post-independence that we started doing stuff. It's not true, right? We were also
Yeah,
doing
and
it.
that part is extremely inspirational for me as well. Since my childhood, I was aware of this, because I also have a very vast Muslim identity, where some of my paternal aunts were not, I mean, they did study, but there wasn't a choice for careers to them. And here there were these great aunts who had traveled for the to participate in World War II. I mean, I was aware that of this distinction, and I kind of knew that this is something big. This was big for that time. And just the fact being matrons in like big hospitals in Delhi and Lucknow, these are all achievements for first generation educated children, and they happen to be women also. They were not sons. They were, so these things, I mean, I think there's so much to take inspiration from in this, in these.
Even today, it's a great thing if you're the matron of a big hospital, or if you're going into war and you're, you know, you're called on to serve. I mean, it's a huge thing even now.
Absolutely.
So that was great. I found that great.
So with, like within their career choices, they excelled, each one of them, with something nice. With And so, imagine that they, their parents, their parents were humble herders. They had animals, and from there, this growth of making careers for their daughters, this is, it's very inspirational.
Very inspirational. And I love that detail about that Gadri, the goat. I never thought of goats as being companions. Or as, you know, when he leaves the goat's child with the children so that they also... I mean, I never thought of goats as pets. I just thought of them as like food or something.
You know, my grandmother, towards the end of her life, actually... And they were living in a very posh colony in Lucknow. And she kept a goat as a pet, one solitary goat as a pet. Her name was Moon Moon. And see, this I thought again is beautiful, because she grew up in that. And then she lived her life, she whatever, had ups and downs. And then when she had her retired life, she actually kept, like, people have dogs and cats in these posh houses. She had a goat called Moon Moon.
Wow. That's fantastic. How long do goats live? Nothing to do with this. But how long do goats live? Don't they just die very quickly? Or do they live like
no, they don't. I think they must be living 10, 15 years. I don't know if they get to live, any of them get to live there. Full life.
Unless they're pets like this. But then you'd know how long they live. Great.
Yeah, so why I told you the story is also for the comfort that one looks for in your life. So you go back to your childhood associations. You know, like, I have never seen anyone else in like in that colony in Lucknow keeping a goat as a pet, because people would flaunt these foreign breed dogs and cats.
I'm walking my goat.
And the goat is so nasty. She used to eat her, I remember two occasions she ate her 500 or 100 rupee notes, and she was like, Moon Moon ne mera note kha liya. Like, unique pet problem.
Yeah, seriously. And on that cheerful note, we'll end. You know, for the listeners, go out and get This Land We Call Home, The Story of a Family, Caste, Conversions in Modern India by Nusrat F. Jafri. It's a great book. It's really a very good read, and it makes you think about a lot of things, and it makes you think of your own identity as an Indian, and of, you know, of this great country that we call home, you know. So thank you so much, Nusrat, for talking to me.
Thank you so much, Najla. It was a pleasure talking to you, and I'm so happy you liked the book.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
To stay updated on this podcast, follow us at HD Smartcast on all the major social media platforms. To listen to more such podcasts, log on to www.hdsmartcast.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.